Good afternoon. My name is Barry Nyman. I'm the Director of Accommodation Counseling and Consulting Services, and I welcome you to the Health and Wellness Lecture Series. This program is sponsored by the Assistant Vice Chancellor for Business Affairs, Vice Chancellor for Business Affairs, the UCSD School of Medicine, the UCSD Healthcare Services, and by CADRE, which is Community Advocates for Disability Rights in Education, which is an association for staff, faculty, students, and others interested in disability issues. And we welcome you today because we've got, I think, a pretty good topic that I think will be of interest to a lot of people. Approximately 15 to 18 years ago, we began to notice that some people were experiencing some pain and difficulty. And it was a new experience here at UCSD, and we discovered that there were things like carpal tunnel syndrome and other types of repetitive strain injuries. And as you can imagine, since that time, things have progressed pretty dramatically. And there's quite a bit of information currently available on the ergonomics page at blink.ucsd.edu on ways that you can learn about ways to prevent or manage repetitive strain injuries. And we're very fortunate today we have one of the experts in the field who's going to share information with us today about treatment and prevention. Dr. Abrams is a professor, and he's the Vice Chancellor of the UCSD Department of Orthopedics. He's also the Chief of Hand and Microvascular Surgery at the UCSD School of Medicine. And Dr. Abrams has, for the past 22 years, been widely recognized as he focused on hand and upper extremity problems, arthritis, and complex elbow reconstruction. Please welcome Dr. Abrams.
Thank you very much. So you mentioned repetitive strain injury, and that is a huge topic, and I'm only going to talk about one small part of this topic and try to dispel some myths and educate you a little bit about carpal tunnel syndrome. Carpal tunnel syndrome is a constellation of signs and symptoms for which there is no objective test or physical finding that's pathognomonic. The essential complaint is intermittent or constant numbness or tingling in the distribution for the median nerve. If you don't have numbness and tingling, you don't have carpal tunnel syndrome. One of the most common complaints is nocturnal tingling. The median nerve distribution is shown in this picture here. It's the area of green. So this is the area you have to be numb to have carpal tunnel syndrome. You can't be just numb anywhere. You have to be numb in the distribution of the median nerve. So carpal tunnel syndrome may be associated, in addition to this numbness, with pain on the palm side of the wrist. The pain may be focal or vague and may radiate as far as proximal as the shoulder. And that's why it frequently is confused with repetitive stress syndrome, where you may have pain in other locations. In very severe cases, it may be associated with weakness of the muscles around the base of the thumb, which are the muscles that are innervated by the median nerve. Sustained forceful or repetitive manual activities can exacerbate symptoms, specifically repetitive pinching or gripping or extreme positioning of the wrist, as is shown. Commonly, patients may get this if they're riding their bicycle with the wrists hyperextended. And though keyboard activity in and of itself is not, and I say not, a high-risk activity for carpal tunnel syndrome, if you keyboard in a way that is non-ergonomic with extreme positioning of the wrist or hand, it can elicit symptoms. So I have some myths I want to dispel. My hand hurts, I must have carpal tunnel syndrome. My hand hurts when I use the computer, I must have carpal tunnel syndrome. Doc, I never use the computer. There's no way I have carpal tunnel syndrome. And I don't want surgery because it doesn't work. Well, not all pain from repetitive hand use is carpal tunnel syndrome. As I alluded to before, there can be other things that cause pain other than carpal tunnel syndrome. And keyboard use, as I mentioned, is not in and of itself a high-risk activity for carpal tunnel syndrome. You can get pain doing the keyboard from something else, maybe, but it may not be carpal tunnel syndrome. Just because you don't use a keyboard doesn't mean that you don't have carpal tunnel syndrome. I have carpal tunnel syndrome. I don't use a keyboard much. And the treatment is usually successful. It's not necessarily surgical treatment, but if surgery is required, the success rate is actually rather high. So, carpal tunnel syndrome is a nerve entrapment syndrome, meaning that there is a nerve in your wrist that gets squashed by structures in that area. It's the most common compressive neuropathy, and depending upon where in the literature you read, may range anywhere from 1/10 to 10% of the population. And high-risk occupations, such as dental hygienists who do a lot of work with heavy repetitive grip in very awkward positions of the wrist, the risk may be as high as 15%. And there are high medical costs. You can see that it's really an important issue. There are a lot of risk factors, and some of them are not work-related. There are certain morbidities, diseases that are associated with them. There are states such as pregnancy where there may be a temporary increased risk, and you can see listed there that there are certainly a lot of things that are associated with carpal tunnel syndrome. So let's talk a little bit about the specifics of what it is. And in doing that, we need to talk a little bit about the anatomy. I'm going to try to educate you in that regard. Now, the carpal tunnel extends from the wrist crease to the mid-palm, or an area that we call Kaplan's cardinal line. And the carpal tunnel is traversed by the 9 flexor tendons that run your fingers and your thumb. And you can sort of see here that these are the 9 flexor tendons I've circled in blue, and they run under the transverse carpal ligament, as does the median nerve, which is signified in yellow. The transverse carpal ligament is circled in red. There is another nerve that runs just next to the carpal tunnel through a different canal that we call Guillain's canal, and I've signified that in kind of the red and brown outline there. And the ulnar nerve, a different nerve runs under that, and the ulnar nerve gives you sensation in the last 2 fingers of the hand. And so numbness in those digits may be related to compression of a different nerve than the median nerve. So you see the ulnar nerve there in yellow. So if we were to make a cross-section through the hand, as I've kind of indicated here in red, we would have a picture that looks like this. And the carpal tunnel is bordered on 3 sides by carpal bones, as I've pointed out in the red arrows, and on the palm side by a ligament. The narrowest part of the carpal tunnel is in a specific area where several carpal bones, named the hamate bone, the capitate bone in the middle, and the trapezial ridge after the trapezium bone, this is the narrowest part of the carpal tunnel. And what's its shape? It's oval, and its width in the narrowest portion is about 20 millimeters or 2 centimeters, not very big. And in the ends towards the elbow and the fingers, or distal and proximal ends, it's about 25 millimeters. So in a sense, it's hourglass shaped. If you were to pour fluid into it, the carpal tunnel behaves like a closed space, and it will fit about 5 to 6 millimeters. So where does the median nerve come from? Well, it starts way up in the neck. The spinal roots, all of the cervical spinal roots, C5, 6, 7, 8, and T1, all give some component to the median nerve. The spinal roots come out of the spinal canal and then come together to form a structure called the brachial plexus. And 2 cords, the medial and lateral cord from the brachial plexus, conjoin to form the median nerve way up in the upper arm. As the median nerve goes down the arm, it innervates most of the muscles in the forearm, not all of them, but most of them. And it innervates most of the muscles in the base of the thumb, or the thenar eminence here, not all of them, but most of them. And finally, the median nerve innervates the thumb side of the hand 3.5 fingers. The ring finger is actually innervated by 2 different nerves. So if you get numbness from the median nerve or compression of the median nerve, it may be confusing at first, but there's an anatomical explanation why you'll feel numb on only 1/2 of the ring finger and not the other half. So what happens in carpal tunnel syndrome? Well, it results when the pressure in that closed space exceeds the tolerance of the median nerve to function. And there are several factors that lead to this. The rate at which the pressure increases has something to do with the symptoms that you'll have. If it's gradual and chronic, that's different than if it's sudden. The magnitude of the pressure is important. And finally, the pressure gradient over the nerve is important. So, axonal transport is the ability of the nerve to transmit its nutrients down the whole axon or the fiber of the nerve. And that can be disrupted with some pressure as low as 20 to 30 millimeters of mercury. And this pressure actually is frequently physiologic. In fact, when you flex or extend your wrist, you can increase the pressure even in normal people to that level. If you increase the pressure a little bit more to 60 or 80 millimeters of mercury, you'll have vascular occlusion, or the blood vessels along the nerve fiber will get compressed. And then finally, if you have high levels of pressure, you'll damage the nerve and have a compression or a conduction block. So chronic compression, which is what usually happens in the kind of carpal tunnel syndrome we're talking about, has similar effects as I just described for acute compression, with the addition that you develop chronic changes in the nerve, such as thickening of the nerve covering or the epineurium, and degeneration of the myelin, which is the specialized portion of the nerve sheath that improves the rate of conduction of impulses down the nerve. So as I mentioned, the carpal tunnel behaves like a closed compartment. Most people who don't have carpal tunnel syndrome have a resting pressure in the carpal tunnel of about 2 millimeters of mercury, and patients with carpal tunnel syndrome may have a resting pressure of 30 millimeters of mercury, which, as you might recall from that previous slide I showed, can already slow the axonal transport. So it increases your risk of developing symptoms when you do high-risk activities if you have a higher pressure in your carpal tunnel. So we know from pressure catheter studies inside the carpal tunnel, that data I just mentioned, if you flex your wrist without carpal tunnel syndrome, you can increase the pressure to 30 millimeters of mercury or a level where you may develop symptoms, even in normal people. But if you have carpal tunnel syndrome, you can vastly increase the pressure within the carpal tunnel and definitely elicit symptoms. Other high-risk activities other than just positioning of the wrist, are heavy pinching or gripping, which can increase the pressure in the carpal tunnel. And certain positions of the forearm and hand can increase pressure in the carpal tunnel. An interesting mechanism is that when you extend your fingers and your wrist fully, some of the muscle bellies that are in the muscles in your forearm can have some incursion into the carpal tunnel, and by that mechanism increase the contents in this closed space and elicit symptoms. The same thing happens if you make a tight fist with some muscles called the lumbricals, which are attached to the flexor tendon in the palm. Again, if you make a fist, those muscles will have some incursion proximally towards the wrist and again increase the contents of the carpal canal in this closed space. There are other things that can increase the contents of the carpal canal too, like masses, like ganglion cysts or anomalous muscles, or what we call a persistent median artery. In development, you have only one artery that runs down the arm, which later divides and creates the radial and ulnar artery. Well, some patients have a persistent median artery, which stays sort of large and engorged. And if that occurs, that median artery travels through the carpal tunnel, increases the contents. Certainly, you can have some acute carpal tunnel syndrome. Say you break your wrist, you might have swelling in your carpal canal and compress the nerve by that mechanism. And there are many other disorders, such as rheumatoid arthritis or gout or chronic renal failure, where you'll create inflammation of the tendons that cause swelling of the tendons in the carpal tunnel and increase contents, which will squash the nerve. I mentioned there are some mechanical factors in high-risk activities, such as cane and wheelchair use. Patients using wheelchairs frequently have their wrists at hyperextended positions and also bear loads on a hyperextended wrist. Vibration exposure also increases the susceptibility of the median nerve to compression. I mentioned some occupational exposures. And then finally, I've given you a picture of a wrist fracture, which shows considerable deformity. And if you imagine this is the palm side of the wrist, that nerve is now stretched over this deformed bone and can cause acute problems with median nerve function. So when talking with patients who have carpal tunnel syndrome, as I mentioned before, it's a syndrome. It's not something I can draw blood or take an x-ray or do an MRI to diagnose, but rather it's something that I have to use a history and physical examination to come up with this diagnosis. And if I were not a talkative person and I needed to still be a hand surgeon, I would ask patients with carpal tunnel syndrome or those in whom I was suspicious had carpal tunnel syndrome one question. The question with the highest yield is whether or not patients have numbness at night or whether or not they wake up in the morning with a numb, tingly hand. That is a high yield or a high risk for carpal tunnel syndrome. It's important to know whether or not the numbness is intermittent or if it's constant. It helps me understand how severe the problem is. If there are certain precipitants, what activities set this off? Is it doing computer use? Is it riding your bicycle? Is it lifting weights? And important to understand whether there are associated medical problems that I may need to treat, because somebody with what we call idiopathic carpal tunnel syndrome will be treated differently than somebody who has rheumatoid arthritis and has inflammatory process going on in their carpal canal. When examining patients, I want to understand exactly where they're numb, because as I mentioned before, they've got to be numb in the right place for this to be really carpal tunnel syndrome. And I want to know how numb they are. And there are some ways to sort of objectify patients' lack or impaired sensation. And we do this with certain tests, and I can talk about them in more detail later for those who are interested, but suffice it to say, there are some quasi-objective tests that will help us understand just how numb people are. I also want to test patient strength, particularly of the muscles innervated by the median nerve at the base of the thumb. And there are some questionnaires that are designed to point out patients who are high risk for carpal tunnel syndrome, including a hand diagram. If you have a patient draw out exactly where they're numb, that'll be very helpful when we're trying to figure out which nerve is involved. There are some provocative tests. If we tap over a nerve that is pathological, sometimes what will happen is it will be like hitting your funny bone and you'll get a tingling out towards the fingers. And if you tap over the wrist where the median nerve is compressed, a positive test or Tinel's sign will be radiation of that numbness, or what we call dysesthesia, into the median nerve distribution, as you see here. Another test that was described by Phelan, who really in the 60s was the hand surgeon who popularized carpal tunnel syndrome as a problem, designed this test called Phelan's test, which, as you can imagine, increases pressure within the carpal tunnel and will elicit those dysesthesias in the median nerve distribution. Another test that was described by Durkin is simply putting pressure over the median nerve at the wrist for half a minute and developing numbness and tingling in the hand. And finally, there are electrodiagnostic studies, which are, and I'll use the word quasi-objective, because there is some art to doing these well, and it's as objective as we get, but we can't really call it a gold standard. And part of the reason is that 8 to 22% of patients who have been diagnosed on clinical criteria as having carpal tunnel syndrome and went on to have surgery and went on to get better, so I think that's pretty good evidence that they had carpal tunnel syndrome, have negative electrical tests. So this is a test that has false negatives, okay? And then, interestingly, we'll do electrodiagnostic studies in some patients to look at other nerve problems, say in the spine or looking at the ulnar nerve, as I mentioned before, and they'll be completely asymptomatic in the median nerve distribution, and they will have positive tests. So here, in a sense, we have a test that also has false positives. So I don't think we can ascribe gold standard status to a test that has false positives and false negatives a significant percentage of the time. So this isn't to say that I don't use them. I think there is some utility. It may help me in confusing patients where they can't really, they're They don't know their anatomy. They say they're numb in a place that just doesn't make sense to me. It may help me in my making a diagnosis. It may identify other sites of compression that maybe I didn't suspect because of from my history or examination. If you have an ambiguous history and physical exam, it's very helpful. I find it's kind of helpful, and I probably use it in this context the most, in trying to figure out the severity. Obviously, I'm a surgeon. So you walk into my office, you're a little nervous. You're not wanting to have an operation. And, I don't operate on everything that walks. And in fact, I try not to operate on patients who have carpal tunnel syndrome until, they're patients that really won't be satisfied unless they have further definitive treatment. I basically treat patients like I would myself. And I mentioned before, I have carpal tunnel syndrome, and there's not a scar on my hand yet. And I can control symptoms by activity modification. We try to do that in most of our patients who have mild to moderate symptoms. But if you're severe and you're actually having nerve damage, I think it's a disservice to rule out surgery as a possible treatment option because it is very satisfying. So in the context of patients who are a little nervous about having surgery, electrodiagnostic studies can sometimes help you make that decision. Because if it's severe, the electrodiagnostic studies can tell you whether or not there's actually damage to the nerves that won't get better unless you have surgery, and in fact may get worse, and may actually get to the point where there is some irreparable damage. And so the electrical test may help us decide that. And then finally, in cases maybe where surgery has failed, electrodiagnostic studies may help us in that setting and show us whether or not there really was decompression of the nerve in its entirety, or if there may be another site of compression that we've missed. So when making the diagnosis, it's a little confusing sometimes. There have been some interesting studies that show that the accuracy of diagnosis might depend on your study population. And another interesting thing that alludes to how we make the diagnosis and whether or not electrodiagnostic studies are absolutely necessary to make the diagnosis is a study by Bob Szabo up in at UC Davis. He showed that if you have these four things, night pain or that night numbness I was talking about, monofilament Semmes-Weinstein testing, which is that objective test I mentioned before that can tell how numb you are, Durkin's test, which is that test where you compress the wrist, and a hand diagram that is fairly anatomically correct that the patient makes for you. If all of those are positive, you have an 86% chance of getting the right diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome. And if they're all negative, it's a less than 1% chance that you've missed the diagnosis. And that's not by drawing blood. That's not by doing any objective test. It's all by doing something right there in the office. And what's interesting is if you add electrodiagnostic studies to those four tests, it doesn't increase your accuracy. So that just sort of a little something about electrodiagnostic studies, a bit of a pet peeve of mine because some patients are so classic, you don't need to torture them with this test, which is a little bit uncomfortable. But here in the state of California, if you want to operate on somebody with this, if they're work comp, got to get that test. So anyway, the differential diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome is really quite vast. So you have to be fairly accurate with your physical examination. You can have compression in the cervical spine, which may mimic carpal tunnel syndrome. You can have compression in the thoracic outlet at the level of the brachial plexus, which may mimic carpal syndrome. And then finally, in the mid-forearm, there's an area where the median nerve can get compressed as well. These areas are much more rare. The most common area of compression above carpal tunnel syndrome that may give you numbness in this area is usually the cervical spine, in my experience, when we're talking about numbness in this distribution. Carpal tunnel syndrome is the number one compressive neuropathy. The number two compressive neuropathy is at the elbow, the ulnar nerve, which is the funny bone. I don't know why they call that the funny bone. It's really a nerve. If they were looking for a bone that was funny, wouldn't they call the humerus the funny bone? Right. So let's talk about treatment of carpal tunnel syndrome. Effective non-surgical treatment in mild to moderate cases of carpal tunnel syndrome, especially in those patients where most of their symptoms are at night or when they wake up, is nighttime splinting. And I swear by this. This is something that I use at night. And in fact, if I wear my splint, I have a better next day. And if I forget to wear it, I'll have worse symptoms during the daytime with my daytime activities. So I really think that nighttime splinting is very useful in those patients who have mostly nighttime and morning symptoms. Definitely modifying activity to avoid or limit repetitive heavy gripping and pinching, or especially doing things that have sustained extreme wrist positioning. Now, a little comment about cortisone injections into the carpal tunnel. Early in my career, I did more injections than I do now. But they do work. The problem is that they're very short-lived and on average work for several months. Most patients don't really find that that's very useful to them. And there may be certain populations in which that's useful. For example, carpal tunnel syndrome associated with pregnancy usually gets better after delivery. And if we can temporize by a cortisone injection into the carpal tunnel, that's very useful. There is also interesting literature that says that general conditioning helps carpal tunnel syndrome, as well as nerve gliding exercises. It's interesting to note that if your nerve gets entrapped in scar at the wrist and cannot glide, it will become pathological. We don't usually think of nerves having excursion through the tissue. We think of tendons gliding through tissue. But it so happens that from this position of the wrist, full flexion to full extension of the wrist, the median nerve, if you use the transverse carpal ligament as a reference point, the median nerve has about a centimeter of excursion. So if the nerve gets entrapped and can't have that natural excursion, it's going to be exposed to all sorts of stresses of friction and tension. So nerve gliding exercises, and even in the OR, you might find me stopping and stretching and making, you know, making my hand more comfortable so that I can function better. This is a list of equivocal or ineffective treatments. And so you should take a look and see that I'm not that open-minded, but the literature would also support that magnets and laser acupuncture and things like that have not been found to be definitively helpful in treating carpal tunnel syndrome. So, what are the indications for doing surgery? Well, they're sort of obvious. If you're not doing better, if you're not doing well enough with non-operative treatment and you're unable to or cannot tolerate the symptoms, surgery is worth considering. I am very concerned about patients who have constant or nearly constant numbness or tingling, because those are the patients who are now bordering on severe symptoms. If you have wasting or weakness of the thenar muscles, that means it's severe. That means there's permanent nerve damage. And in fact, if you do a carpal tunnel release in a person who has weakness or wasting of the thenar muscles, they may get some improvement of their pain, of their numbness, but they will not get any recovery of the muscle problem that they have. So you really want to address this before this happens. And the bottom line there saying that there is electrodiagnostic study evidence of denervation of the thenar muscles, that's just the electrical test manifestation of nerve damage to the muscle fibers at the base of the thumb. So what is surgery for? What do we do? It is, by the way, the most common operation that I do, and I do a lot of different operations. My practice I may do, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 carpal tunnel releases a week, and I probably do 20 cases a week. So that's not including call. So what are we doing when we do a carpal tunnel release? What we're doing is we're opening that closed space and making it bigger. It's fairly logical. We decompress the median nerve. And of course, we want to do that in a way where we cause no morbidity. In other words, we don't want to damage the nerve, either nerve, the median or ulnar nerve. We don't want to damage important blood vessels in that area. And, of course, we don't want to damage tendons. And finally, we want to do it in a way that's very meticulous and gentle so that we minimize the dissection, reduce postoperative swelling, stiffness, and scarring and adhesions. So what we're doing is we're cutting or lengthening that ligament on the palm side of the carpal tunnel. And what we've found by studies that we've looked at patients with MRI after carpal tunnel release, we can look at the cross-section of the carpal canal, and we see that the carpal canal is enlarged. The cross-sectional area of the carpal canal is bigger by 25%. And finally, when we look in the carpal canal, we want to look for abnormal contents, such as masses or increased inflammation or synovitis or things like that, to increase the available area for the nerve. So when we do a carpal tunnel release, there are several different ways to do this. And the old way, I would say old way, but the way that we did it until about late 80s to early 90s was a more extensile incision, as you see, that enters the hand and the wrist. And this is a bigger dissection and can certainly cause some morbidity. Here, by the way, is the way the carpal tunnel looks after a carpal tunnel release. You can see some of the tendons that run the fingers, and this hourglass-shaped structure that was compressed in the middle is the median nerve, and you can see what happens to the median nerve when it's really squashed, and you can barely make out the leading edge of the transverse carpal ligament that's been incised and sort of everted so that you can see the inside of the carpal canal. As it became apparent that the dissection made it difficult for patients to recover, the incision started to get smaller. And that was actually encouraged in part because there was a move towards doing this procedure endoscopically, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But we make more miniature incisions. The incision that I make now is about 1.5 to 2 centimeters in the mid-palm, as demonstrated by the little red line on the slide. Now, as I mentioned, endoscopic carpal tunnel release became popular, I would say, in the early to mid-90s. And endoscopic means doing this procedure with an instrument that has a camera and a knife on the end of it, where you're not actually exposing the surgical site. And you can see in my little diagram here, an instrument is being inserted through a 1 to 2 centimeter transverse incision at the wrist, and it's passed underneath the transverse carpal ligament, next to the nerve, next to all those arteries I mentioned, next to those tendons I mentioned, and you pull a trigger and deploy a blade, and you cut the transverse carpal ligament from the inside. Now, there are some things that there have been excellent studies, and in some cases, 2 or 3 very well-controlled, prospective, randomized studies that show what's not necessary. So if you go into a doctor's office and they say, along with your carpal tunnel release, I'm going to do an epineurotomy, which means opening the covering of the nerve, and I'm going to do an internal neurolysis, which means I'm going to pull out the microscope and dissect out all the little fibers, and I'm going to do a tenosynovectomy, you should go to a different doctor because he hasn't been reading. Now, these may be important for revision carpal tunnels or situations where there's tremendous scar around the nerve, but in the routine idiopathic case, it's been well shown that any of these 3 things don't improve the outcomes and can certainly worsen the outcomes because the more meddling, the more scar, the more morbidity. So, this hasn't really been a party line, but there is some literature that suggests that releasing the transverse ligament may lead to some diminished grip strength. So there has been a push for just lengthening the ligament. And while there is cadaver biomechanical evidence that suggests that this improves grip strength over just simply releasing it, Cadavers, you know, don't behave like living people. And it's been my experience, quite frankly, that these ligaments do heal even after they're released. And so I feel that sort of this may be the law of diminishing returns, and may cause more dissection than is really necessary. So I've personally, and most of my colleagues, have strayed from trying to do something like this and try to stay to the smaller incisions. You can't do this through a small incision. So let's talk a little bit about the outcomes of surgery, what we see in the literature. Conservative treatment, at least short-term success with splinting and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, ranges 15 to 20%, which is not that high. But I think in certain cases of mild to moderate carpal tunnel syndrome, if you can ferret out and choose that as your treatment population, your successes may be higher. There are some things that are that diminish your success rate, and that is increasing age, and unfortunately I'm over 50. As you get worsening symptoms such as constant tingling, if you have a positive Phalen's test that has been present for more than 10 months, and mine has, unfortunately, and if you have an inflammatory process, which not many people have actually with idiopathic, but in cases where you have something increasing the contents of the carpal tunnel, all of these things have been associated with a more poor prognosis. And I mentioned before briefly the prognosis of cortisone injections. They're really only appropriate and safe in patients who have mild to moderate symptoms. They're successful about 80% of the time in the short term, but after a year and a half, only 20% of patients still were relatively symptom-free. Surgery has a high success rate. There was an interesting study done here actually at Sharpe-Reese-Steele with Alain Guéret, one of my colleagues in town, was the lead author of this study. I don't have the data exactly memorized, but the thing that I do remember about his study was that in patients with mild to moderate carpal tunnel syndrome who end up having surgery, if they fill out an outcome, a validated outcome score before surgery and after surgery, they're more satisfied with surgical treatment than they were with their non-surgical treatment. So even patients who have intermittent symptoms, you know, once you have the surgery, I think you're happier if you had a good result, if you didn't have a complication, because you don't have to worry about it anymore. You're not sitting there wearing splints all night long and, you know, being really careful to do your nerve glide exercises and avoiding certain activities. So patient satisfaction in general is better, even for mild to moderates, after surgery. It's just that surgery has risks and it's a hassle and there's downtime and so on and so forth. So a successful result does not necessarily mean that you're absolutely symptom-free, although most of the time in my experience that's true. But occasionally patients may have a symptom here or two, here or there. Up to 25% in the literature of patients have had symptoms or a recurrence, and that's what we would call an unsuccessful result. As I mentioned before, the intermittent symptoms or the nocturnal symptoms resolve more quickly than constant symptoms or daytime symptoms. And what you can expect after a carpal tunnel release is this. Initially, after the carpal tunnel release, patients who have mild to moderate carpal tunnel syndrome, namely patients who have intermittent symptomatology, that gets better very quickly. And usually after you come back for your first postoperative visit to get your stitches out a week down the line, that's usually better. If you have pain that's associated with it, that usually gets better very quickly. There are some patients who have kind of both constant and intermittent symptoms. In other words, it waxes and wanes in its intensity, but there's always some low-grade numbness or tingling. And so those patients, what happens in them is their intermittent or worse symptoms get better very quickly. The low-grade numbness and tingling takes much longer to get better, and of course the pain gets better. And the way I imagine is what's going on is that those constant symptoms are actually damage to the nerve or to the myelin sheath. Well, biology has to work there. You've got to heal your myelin sheath, you've got to regrow axons and so on. That doesn't happen right away. But the symptoms that come on simply from the mechanical compression, once you get that compression off, you feel much better after that. Okay, and the last thing I forgot to mention is that it takes about 3 to 6 months, depending upon which article you quote, for your grip strength to fully recover. So I tell my patients, if they are moderate laborers, they do work where they may do some lifting, say janitorial type of work, I'll send them back to work about 2 months because they'll be capable of doing those sorts of tasks. If you're a pipe fitter or a mechanic and you have to have your maximal grip strength back to hold wrenches, that usually takes 3 to 6 months. Okay, so there are some poor prognostic indicators for patients who are considering surgery. As you get older, as it gets worse, the likelihood of improvement is less. And if there is associated other reasons for sick nerves, like diabetes or chronic renal failure, that worsens your prognosis. And it's not to say that patients who fit in these categories won't derive some benefit from their surgery, but they may not get completely better. So I said I was going to mention the big controversy in carpal tunnel syndrome, of course, is whether or not to do this open or endoscopically. And so why would you even think about doing this one way or the other if the final outcome is the same? Well, the benefit of endoscopic carpal tunnel release is that you're back to work earlier and it hurts less. And there are a couple of good controlled prospective randomized studies that show that you get back to work roughly about 2 weeks sooner if you had it done endoscopically versus open. And, you know, these studies are full of caveats, like what kind of work? I mean, this is an average, okay, that you get back to work a couple of weeks earlier. The other thing is how are these patients motivated? They're not really stratified very well. You know, if you're self-employed, you're kind of motivated to get back to work really quickly, and if it's not a heavy type of labor job, a lot of patients go back to work before their stitches are out. And I'm reminded of my self-employed construction worker who had plaster all over his hands. He had bilateral carpal tunnel releases simultaneously and came back to my office after he'd been hanging drywall and had plaster all over his hands. And of course, you know, that's one end of the spectrum, and then there's the other end of the spectrum where patients, you know, are still dysfunctional after a few months. But, you know, the average time is, as I mentioned before, where, you know, high gripping and high intense hand use people are back to work by roughly 3 months. So in any case, it's hard to judge how good endoscopic carpal tunnel release is, and it's a little less painful, but as our incisions are getting smaller, I would be curious to recompare this with our smaller incisions. The problem, of course, with endoscopic carpal tunnel release, and this is what I'll tell you in the office, is that you don't see everything. You know, it's like looking for a ping pong ball in a dark gym through the keyhole when you use an endoscopic instrument. What you're doing is you're putting the instrument in, looking for what you're trying to cut, hoping there's nothing else in view, and making your cut. And you miss things like, is there something in the carpal tunnel else that you need to take care of? Or am I not seeing this very clearly? Is it possible I may damage something? So I think that endoscopic carpal tunnel release may be a little riskier, but there may be certain situations where it may be a better treatment of choice. And I do it both ways, but way less often with the endoscopic technique now, and much less than I used to. So if you get carpal tunnel syndrome again after you had a successful release, and you know, patients get recurrences a year later, I've had patients who get it 20 years later, What's the success rate in those patients? Well, less than it usually is the first time. But still, reoperation success rates in the literature are about 80% successful. So in summary, I want to just remind you that carpal tunnel syndrome is a specific syndrome. It has to do with the median nerve that runs through the carpal canal, and the median nerve innervates sensation to the thumb, index, long, and half of the ring finger, and it runs through the carpal canal along with the flexors that run the fingers and thumb. And this canal is bordered on three sides by a bone and on the palm side by a very thick ligament called the transverse carpal ligament. Carpal tunnel syndrome occurs when the pressure within that closed space of the carpal tunnel is too high on the nerve. And very important to remember that the essential symptom that you must have to be diagnosed as having carpal tunnel syndrome is numbness and tingling in the median nerve distribution. It may also have associated pain and weakness, but remember, not all hand pain is carpal tunnel syndrome. Important to evaluate the patient and have a good physical examination to locate the area of complaint. Electrodiagnostic studies are controversial, but in certain situations are helpful, in my opinion. Non-operative treatment is frequently helpful in patients with mild to moderate carpal tunnel syndrome, and that includes activity modification, namely avoiding heavy and repetitive pinching, extreme wrist positioning, and nighttime splinting. Injections may be helpful, but usually only for a short period of time, and surgery is useful in cases where conservative treatment has failed, and it's usually successful. Thank you. That's all I have. I have 5 minutes for questions, and I'll go from this end of the room to this end. Okay? Well, it's certainly intuitive and rational to think that it will keep it from progressing if you take the pressure off of the nerve. And, you know, I've heard myself say that to patients. And so in patients who are 60 and older, like you'll run into the 80 or 90-year-old patient who has phenar atrophy, but they have a tremendous amount of pain and a tremendous amount of numbness, and the quality of their life is quite altered. They can't dress. They can't do their buttons. I talk to those patients and say, you know, you may derive some benefit from surgery because you may get partly better. You won't get your strength back. You won't get this weakness to go away, but you may get the pain to go away. You may get some of the numbness to go away. And I usually tell them it may stop the progression from getting worse, especially if they're noting progression. So, but I really warn them and say there are some patients who don't really get better at all afterwards.
But they don't get worse?
They usually don't get worse. I mean, some, you know, surgery is...
They end up not being able to do their buttons.
Right, if they start being able to do their buttons, I hopefully won't stop them from being able to do their buttons.
No. But I mean, if at this point you can certainly do your buttons, you have the surgery, you will never then progress to that point, say, 10 years down the line, where you become more crippled.
I can't answer that. There's no study that helps me with that, and I don't have the experience of following a patient like that for 10 years. Let me just finish your question with saying that I will frequently rationalize in patients who have some poor prognostic signs that they should consider surgery to prevent progression.
Dr. Abrams, could you repeat the questions that you're asked, please?
Sure. I thought she was very articulate and spoke loud enough that I didn't have to do that, but I will do that. Next. Other questions? In the back? Yes.
What
Okay. The question was reiterating that there are false positives and false negatives for electrodiagnostic studies in the context of the median nerve. And the question was, are there similar false positives and negatives for the ulnar nerve? And off the top of my head, I don't have the studies memorized for that. But I can tell you that in my experience, I have a lot of patients in whom I've done electrodiagnostic studies to look at median neuropathy, and they also have ulnar neuropathy that's not symptomatic. And it actually is fairly common for patients as they age to develop some slowing of conduction around the elbow and not be symptomatic from that. So I would categorize that as a false positive for ulnar neuropathy as well. I think it's a test that requires experience, it's artful, and has to be put in the context of the patient's symptoms and physical examination in general. There are some nerve compressions, such as the radial nerve in the forearm and the thoracic outlet, where electrodiagnostic studies can't even pick up problems there, and it's purely based on clinical diagnosis. Purple shirt, that's you, sort of. Yes, there are studies on this, and again, I'm not can't memorize the number, but a large number. I can say this: a large number of patients with pregnancy get carpal tunnel syndrome, and a majority of them get better once they deliver, but not everybody. And so I've run into a lot of scenarios. One is a patient like you where they don't get better. I've had the scenario where she actually was worked in the repro med department here, who had a carpal tunnel syndrome that got worse with every pregnancy. And finally, after her last pregnancy, her third one, she didn't get better and ended up having to have a carpal tunnel release. So there are all sorts of scenarios, and yours is not that uncommon, although you are not the majority. Red shirt? So the question is, after pregnancy, had to use a walker, and you developed hand pain after that, and your doctor diagnosed that as having tendonitis from using the walker. And all I can say from that is I would have to examine you to make that diagnosis. Patients can get tendonitis from using walkers. Patients will get a typical type of wrist tendonitis after pregnancy, and it doesn't come from walker use necessarily. So I think that's a whole different topic. And in front?
You mentioned that using the computer is a low risk for carpal tunnel syndrome. And so what is the keyboard high risk for?
Well, it's not necessarily high risk for anything. There's an interesting Mayo study, Mayo Clinic, huge medical center, a lot of ward clerks doing a lot of typing, grabbing files, doing these repetitive activities. They had the same risk of developing carpal tunnel syndrome as the general population. So that's kind of the study I like to quote to indicate that keyboard use isn't a high-risk activity for carpal tunnel syndrome. Now, patients get a lot of pain from typing with the keyboard, and, you know, it's just like running in a sense. You know, if I typed for 5 minutes, my arms would get sore. I am totally deconditioned for typing, and when I have to write a paper or copy something, I'm stopping every 5 minutes to stretch, and it makes you sort of sore. Yet, on the other hand, you've got transcriptionists who are typing a million miles an hour, 8 hours a day, and they're doing pretty well. I mean, every so often I'll run into one in my office. But I think it's a matter of conditioning and stretching and being ergonomic and so on. So I think a lot of activities are, you know, some activities can be high risk if you do them poorly and without being conditioned. you know, way back in the early 90s, I remember going to a lecture by a very well-known orthopedic surgeon, Charlie Rockwood, who wrote sort of the textbook on fractures. And, you know, there was a controversy then as to whether or not there was such a thing as repetitive trauma. And I remember this lecture where he was talking about repetitive trauma and he was getting a lot of guff about his beliefs. So he asked a resident in the front row to come up. And he grabbed the residents. He was kind of a rough, kind of a cowboy. He's from Texas. And he grabbed his beeper, and he tapped him on the shoulder. And he looked at the resident and said, "Did that hurt?" The resident, of course, said no. He said, "Well, what if I did it 1,000 times? Would it hurt then?" And, of course, your intuition says probably would. So that's repetitive trauma. And if you do something that's sort of natural, and injure the same thing over and over and over and over again, even though it's a natural activity, if you're deconditioned, I think you'll make yourself hurt. Really, really good question, especially since it's that's probably my main hobby is cycling. So I love cycling, and I have carpal tunnel syndrome, and every time I go out, I get a little hand numbness. And I can't ride a mountain bike or a hybrid because it has one handlebar and one position that you can ride, and that's it. And if you ride a road bike, there are many different options for placing your hand, and you'll find people will treat their cycling numbness problems with just changing hand position over and over and over again, just switching around and stretching and things like that. But the reason why cycling is a risk factor is that you're at extreme positioning of the wrist and putting pressure on the carpal tunnel. It's not just a risk factor for carpal tunnel syndrome, but also for that nerve that's just next door I mentioned, the ulnar nerve, because you can put pressure there too. And if you read any cycling book, there'll be a little paragraph or chapter or something on nerve compressions in the hand. At least any good book will have that. And so in cycling, avoiding those extreme positioning and trying to keep your wrist straight, trying to avoid pressure on your hand, and if you have pressure, try to adjust. And then finally, I found that padded cycling gloves, there are some handlebar tapes that have gel in them that are soft, and you know, anything that you can diminish the compression, those kinds of things. Well, I don't know if you've ever seen a cadaver specimen or even a fresh specimen of someone, of a patient. But if you grab the spine with your bare hands and you try to move something, you can't do it. So then imagine on the outside of the body with skin and slippery things all around trying to move the spine. I don't really know that that's what chiropractic is doing. There is evidence that chiropractic does help problems with the back. Don't get me wrong. When I'm saying that chiropractic doesn't cure carpal tunnel syndrome, that's specifically what I'm talking about, is that you can't increase the size of the carpal canal by manipulating the hand. I don't know what the chiropractor is doing. He may be doing some nerve gliding exercises that help movement. There are a lot of things that you can do to help nerve gliding in the thoracic outlet. Hard for me to know without knowing what your mom actually has. And as I alluded to, there are a lot of different reasons why you may get numbness, and it depends on what nerve and so on and so forth. So I don't think I still don't think, despite your comment, that chiropractic will cure carpal tunnel syndrome. But I don't mean to discount the utility of chiropractic in some of musculoskeletal ailments. More by starting the IV. We use a tourniquet during the surgery so that we don't have any blood loss, and more importantly, so that we can see what we're doing. The man who popularized using a tourniquet in hand surgery was Sterling Bunnell, and he has a great quote that says that trying to operate on the hand without using a tourniquet is like trying to fix a watch in a puddle of ink. So, no blood loss.
I like to know, the doctor says that I have a trigger finger.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same with, like, the thumb?
Uh-huh. It is not uncommon for carpal tunnel and trigger fingers to be associated, but they're not the same thing, and they're treated totally differently. I think that's all the time I have for questions. Otherwise, I might get a parking ticket.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.